Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The room you happen to be sitting in could be struck by a meteor in the next 23 seconds. That makes perfect sense, but the probability is, of course, 0.0000, etc., 1.
It's not zero, but it's extremely low. I'm predicting that rather than be struck by a meteor, you'll be entertained and maybe learn something if you tune into Freakonomics Radio, hosted by my next guest, Stephen Dubner, who wrote the books Freakonomics and Super Freakonomics with fellow economist Steve Levitt. WNYC, as many of you know, is airing Freakonomics Radio specials every day this week, and that clip we heard is a University of Pennsylvania professor who has studied pundits and their predictions, the subject of one of the radio hours. We'll also talk about other topics that you can catch this week: parenting, suicides, and quitting. So welcome back to the show, Stephen Dubner.
Hey, Brian. Thank you.
Philip Tetlock, who we heard in that clip, points to the magic word could be hit by meteor in the next 23 seconds, which seems to absolve predictions from being wrong.
Exactly. Could is the fantastically, perfectly, wonderfully efficient hedge word. So what this hour, the hour we made, is called the folly of prediction. And it's a very basic thesis, which I happen to like. I guess I'm the guy who made it. I should like it. The thesis was human beings love to predict the future. In fact, seem to need to very much predict the future. It's part of our, component in a way. But we're terrible at it. We've gotten better over the years at some things. Some things we do quite well. But many things that are very, very important, politics, the economy, even sports, it's very hard to predict. Why? Because life is random, and it's hard to factor in those random events. And yet, people keep on predicting, and they're almost never measured and almost never punished. So we propose some alternative solutions.
Accountability measures.
Absolutely.
For political pundits.
Would be nice. Every time somebody's on CNN or Fox, you see that, how did they do over their last 100 predictions? On what kind of dimension were they right or wrong? And Philip Tetlock, this guy you played a clip, he did a very nice empirical study of top-tier political pundits and economists predicting the political future of different places, and found that they were, on average, a little bit better than you or me sitting here flipping a coin.
So listeners, if you've read the Freakonomics books or if you've been listening to Freakonomics Radio and you have a question for Stephen Dubner.
Or a prediction.
You can call in and make it now. Stephen Dubner is in. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Do you have any astounding predictions, listeners, from your memory that actually came true? God, when George Will predicted that, whatever it is, or any spectacular failures, call us 212-433-WNYC. Every year, John Sterling predicts that the... Okay, 212-433-9692. You can also weigh in on the other topics that we'll address with Stephen as we go along here, the economics of parenting. He says parenting experts often don't know the data. Suicide and quitting, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I predict that we'll get some very interesting questions for Stephen Dubner. By the way, let's just take one step back for just a few seconds. For people who maybe don't know, the origin of your work, define maybe Freakonomics for us. What makes something fit into your brand of economics?
Honestly, it's a little bit like the answer about the Supreme Court and pornography. It's hard to say what it is, but I know it when I see it. So we do use the tools of economics. So I'm a writer by training, a journalist, and my co-author Steve Levitt is an economist at the University of Chicago. And we mix and match and collaborate, and we use economic methodology and the tools of economic research, I should say, and a kind of way of thinking about the world, but apply them to non-economic topics often. So we don't really write about what most people call the economy. We write about things from, cheating and parenting and baby names and corruption and things like that. But we use a different methodology instead of typical journalism, which I've done a lot of, where, if you find three anecdotes that line up, that's a trend. That's your bell curve.
That's enough for a journalist, if not a scientist.
Absolutely. For a scientist, but the way that economics researchers do it is instead of being happy talking to 3 or 5 or even 100 people, you try to gather data from hundreds of thousands of incidents of modern life. So what we try to do is we try to measure modern life and then write about it in story form. Simple as that. In terms of what makes it Freakonomics or not, again, kind of personal taste, I hate to say.
So back to the accountability for people who make bad predictions, One remedy being proposed in Romania, where some legislators want to regulate the witch industry, a.k.a. fortune-telling. Here is Vlad Mixic, a reporter in Bucharest.
So if you are one of my clients and if I'm a fortune teller, if I fail to predict your future, I would pay quite substantial fine to the state. Or if this happens many times, I will even go to jail. The punishment is between 6 months and 3 years in jail.
Wow.
Now, this is only a proposal, probably not going to pass in Romania, but I like it. And I like it because, as you said, it attaches accountability to predictions. So I like the idea that financial pundits or political pundits or even sports pundits, they kind of get a free pass. The incentives are there to encourage everybody to predict, because almost never is someone penalized, unless they're putting their own money in the game, for making a prediction that turns out to not be true. And you said something a minute ago that was right on the money. Those anomalous predictions, the wild ones that turn out to be true, Joe Namath predicting that the Jets would beat the Colts, the reason we remember them is because they are so dang rare. Everybody, but if you think about it, the loser of the Super Bowl every year predicts they're going to win, and those are the ones we fail to remember.
Probably the week before the Super Bowl, every year, a reporter asks each coach, are you going to win? And he says, we're going to win.
Right, because you're fired if you say no, of course not. So we all make predictions all the time with no accountability. So in Romania, where they want to penalize witches or fortune tellers, I say, why stop at fortune tellers? Let's bring it on to the financial and economic pundits.
The Sunday morning talk shows won't have anybody left. It's funny about the
Well, they'd have a different kind of conversation, wouldn't they? You know what they'd say? They'd say, you know, the future will probably be quite a bit like the recent past. And in terms of what will change, I really don't know, which is an incredibly un-TV-like thing to say, which is exactly why TV producers don't want the people who actually are better predictors, because most predictions will tell you that the future will be mostly like the past, and the ways it will differ, I can't tell you.
On the fortune tellers, I once had a tarot card reading that made me think, the good ones here speak in generalities and have a lot of plausible deniability. So she told me things like, you like to do things in pairs. So you're going to have this kind of thing balancing that kind of thing in your life, whatever they are. But they're going to tend to run in pairs because you're not satisfied with just one thing. Well, who could prosecute her for that?
Exactly. And then beyond that, then you have like what's called a recency bias. When you hear or see something in the recent past, then your mind looks to confirm that. So all of a sudden you see, oh, yes, that was a pair where you may not have recognized it before.
I think we hear that on the business reports every single
Oh, well, on the business reports every day, there's one major fallacy, which is a business reporter will tell you why the market rose or fell. They don't know why the market rose or fell. It depends. I could ask 10 different people and they'd give you 10 different answers. Might one of them be right? Maybe. But the market rises and falls for a very complex set of often random occurrences and a lot of psychology. And yes, psychology is hard to predict.
And to my ear, they always predict the continuation of whatever trend we're in the middle of right now. Scott in Westchester has a prediction. Scott, you're on WNYC with Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics Radio. Hi.
Hi, guys. I want to predict that yet again, America is going to elect another corporate-owned puppet for president.
All right. Thank you very much. You know, Stephen, this is interesting to me because, you know, maybe for a different reason than Scott might have thought. Okay, so he's making a somewhat funny, cynical prediction. But I have read that pessimists' views of the future tend to be more accurate than optimists. Is there data that backs that up? Have you looked at it?
From what I know, I wouldn't quite say that is true. I think that optimism usually wins versus pessimism, unless you're talking utopian versus apocalyptic. In other words, general mild and realistic optimism. I mean, if you think about the state of the world today, we are so far better off on average around the world than we were 100 years ago. It's laughable that people could think otherwise. Crime, public health, education, finance, poverty, on and on. Do big problems still exist? Absolutely. Has the world gotten better? almost immeasurably. And yet, you'd find that most people would think, oh my goodness, the world is getting worse.
Do a public opinion poll. Everything's going to pot.
Absolutely. On the other hand, if you get into, like I said, the extreme utopian versus apocalyptic rarely comes true, but utopian comes true even less often. So I would say that generally, if you're an optimist, your predictions are a little bit more likely to be true unless you go out on a limb to the utopian.
Bet on the apocalypse, Stephen Dubner, 2011. Nicole in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicole.
Hi. I was just calling because it seems to me that people who predict the weather, i.e. meteorologists, weathermen, weatherwomen, their whole job is based on prediction, and yet I don't know any field in which there's less accountability. Every time they forecast a blizzard of 12 inches and we don't get a single flake, I always wonder, how come there's no accountability? There's no one that ever says, you know, you've been wrong 3 out of 10 times.
Yeah, that's a great comment. So we actually ran something on the Freakonomics blog a while back where an amateur, just a guy with his daughter was like maybe 11, 12, they'd noticed that whenever they were planning a camping trip based on their local weather, lived somewhere in the Midwest, turned out to be totally wrong. So they did a data analysis of their local stations. I think they were in Kansas City. Turns out that well, in a broad sense, meteorologists are pretty good at predicting the weather about 2.5 days out. You get past 3, it's a crapshoot. Now, if you're in summer, you know it's not going to be 20 degrees. If it's in winter, you know it's not going to be 80 degrees. But they are quite bad. And you are absolutely right, Nicole. The accountability on TV weather people is practically nil. There was a famous case in Philly where a guy made a bet, essentially. He made a bold prediction that there was a bad winter storm coming, didn't come, ridiculed for it, threatened a little bit, and ended up leaving town, but not entirely because of that. And then he ended up coming back to Philly anyway, and it turned out to be all right. So even that was forgiven.
But I tend to defend meteorologists because, unlike political pundits or sports pundits or fortune tellers in Romania, they really are pursuing science. And when they make predictions, they usually couch it in terms of, you know, 30% chance of rain and things like that. And they don't really make a claim, do they? I mean, yes, we do see the 7-day forecast show up on the TV these days. Maybe that's a little bit of drift in the standards.
Yeah, if you had a 3-day forecast, and you, like I said, if you get a 3-day forecast in terms of temperature range and precipitation probability, and you're right, sometimes 70% probability is the best you can hope for. It's hard, you know, you can't say with certainty. But the problem is that you give a little and then you try to take a whole lot more. And if you try, think about this problem. Here's a really big problem facing humankind today. What's the climate of the future? Okay. The best scientists who know the most will tell you that they are trying to build the best models that they can. And these models are at this moment in time incredibly incomplete. If it's hard to predict weather, local weather 4 days out, how hard is it to predict climate 20 years out? Part of this is about computing power, and we're getting better all the time. So 10 years from now, our climate models will probably be much better. Hopefully our 7-day weather models will be better too.
Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics Radio. We're going to take a break and continue. And I predict that we're going to move on from predictions after the break and play some clips from some of his shows on parenting advice and how it does not always conform to the data on child development. Also, some on suicide and quitting. So we're going to clear the board of calls on predictions. And if you want to call about any of these three other things, we're going to squash as many of them as we can into the next 15 minutes. Parenting, suicide, and quitting through the eyes of the data sets. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're having some fun with numbers with Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics Radio. The series that they just completed is re-airing all this week, 3 o'clock this afternoon, and all the weekdays this week at FM 93.9, 3 o'clock on 93.9 FM, and 8 o'clock in the evening on AM 820 WNYC. And one of the episodes airing this week deals with parenting. you run into two different schools of thought on parenting. There's the helicopter parents, and here's some data on that. This is economist Valerie Ramey from your show.
In the 1980s, the average young college-educated mother spent 13 hours per week on childcare. Now it's 22 hours a week. Now, what's interesting is over this same time period, the wages of college-educated women have really increased. So the opportunity cost of time has increased at the same time they've decided to spend more time taking care of their children.
Now, that's interesting, and it suggests that maybe your fellow Freakonomics founder, Steve Levitt, is onto something with his approach, which he explains here.
Most of them just lazy. You know, I could be investing in the kids, or I could be, you know, indulging my own, you know, hobbies and sleeping and things. And so I'm sort of lazy. I mean, the other problem I have is I have four kids. If you have too many kids, you can't invest that heavily in any one of them because you go crazy.
Oh, what a contrarian, not upping the amount of time compared to his parents that he spends in active child-rearing.
Exactly. So it is an interesting contrast. So Valerie Ramey, whom we heard from first, she identified a really stunning development in modern parenting, which is that as more people got more education, as more parents got more education, and therefore their earning abilities rose, they started spending more time taking care of their kids. Why on earth would that be? Maybe they just liked it more, right? But that's never the way it had been before. It had always been that the more income you had, the more you bought childcare, so you didn't have to do it all yourself. It turns out this is signifies what Ramey identifies as the rugrat race. In other words, the feeling that we need to program into our children as much aptitude as we can, in part because the competition for good colleges, to get into good colleges, has gotten so much stiffer over the years that you have to pack that life with traits, abilities, background that is going to be transferable or attractive to a college applications officer. On the other hand, there is, as you said, my co-author Steve Levitt, who says, you know, I'm lazy and therefore I don't really push my kids that hard. But that also fits in with his interpretation and my interpretation of the data. The data say that, and this is very shocking to a lot of people, and forgive me if you hate this message, because you might if you're a parent. The data say that parents just don't matter anywhere near as much as we parents like to think. So for every baby Mozart tape and flashcard and museum visit and fencing lesson and Mandarin lesson and so on, yes, if your kids love this and if you love it and it makes you happy, great. But in terms of the culture cramming particularly, if you look at the data and how it pays off in terms of happiness, in terms of education, in terms of income, parents matter much less than we like to think. And therefore, what might be the best parenting attitude is to say, let's do what makes everybody happy. And the happier we are, probably the more successful we'll be.
Or maybe parenting only matters little at the polar extreme of, you know, where you're talking about
the
baby Mozart and the fencing, because I imagine there's plenty of data at the other extreme that would prove that kids who were severely abused or neglected are statistically more likely, to put it in cold statistical terms, you know, to have very, very troubled lives.
That's a really good point, and that's exactly the point that I'm always trying to make to the economists who say to me, parenting doesn't matter that much. And then I say, everything we're looking at here is kind of on the up end, on the upside, on the upper end. So, that, for instance, they look at adoption data. What kind of families adopt? Typically, they tend to be a little bit higher income, right? The fact is that unwantedness is the single most damaging parenting trait that a child can have. If you are, which by the way is the reasoning behind my co-author Steve Levitt's most controversial ever theory linking abortion, the legalization of abortion, to a drop in crime. The theory being that the less unwanted births there are, the fewer criminals there will be, right? So you're absolutely right. On the other side of the scale, not the parents who can afford to and would think of doing fencing lessons, wanting your children matters a great deal. Now, that said, even the upper-end parents that we talk to, and this episode about parenting, it's kind of an economist's roundtable on parenting. All of the economists are parents. The biggest thing that I learned from this that I found really kind of heartwarming is that while parents may not matter as much as we think on the empirical scale, the thing that matters a lot, the thing that children take with them into their adult-grown lives, is warmth and kindness and a feeling of belonging to a family. And you know what? You can't offshore that. Yeah. So
I don't suppose you looked at the Freakonomics of violent video games. Of course, we were just talking about parenting rules for that in the first hour of the show, thanks to yesterday's Supreme Court ruling. And we had a data-driven guest, actually, Cheryl Olson, who had that op-ed in the Times today, who says, you know, the data does not conclusively show that violent video games are actually bad for minors and may even serve some useful developmental functions, like letting them do things on the screen rather than in real life.
Absolutely not. I mean, the research on this is a little bit on the mixed side, but generally, a lot of things that parents think are really good for their kids or conversely are really bad for their kids are, in fact, they operate in different mechanisms. So if you think about it, here's an interesting argument. This is a controversial argument, and it's not fully empirically proven, but it's an argument worth thinking about. There is an argument that the decrease in sexual assault over the past 20 years or so is due in some part, at least, to the availability of more online pornography. That the availability of porn has given serves as a substitute to some degree. If that's true, there are a lot of arguments like that. In other words, getting your violent yearning out via a video game, being a horror flick, whatever, does that potentially decrease actual violence? The evidence mounting seems to be that it might, which is exactly counter to the typical parent's fear.
Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics, Freakonomics Radio. Leroy in Fort Greene, you're on WNYC. Your call is about parenting, right?
Yes. And all the things, in Dubner's claim that parents don't matter, what he really listed were services that parents buy, like Mandarin lessons and soccer and piano and all of that. But what about the time that parents spend with their kids? I'd be willing to bet you that if you looked at that, you'd find that parents matter greatly.
Well, that's a little bit of what the tape that you heard at the beginning there, Leroy, from a professor named Valerie Ramey was talking about, whereas parents increased very much the amount of time they were spending with their kids. Part of the problem here is you're right. We can't really measure what happens in every household, but what we do know is that when parents increase their time a lot, when they go from, as she said, you know, something like 13 hours a week to 22 hours a week over the course of a decade, she did try to isolate what did those extra 9 hours a week, what happened then? Was it hanging out, loving your kid, playing board games and whatnot? She found that the answer to that was no, that it was mostly pursuing these kind of more, not necessarily high-end activities, but activities that are thought to be in some ways an investment in a kid's future, and that the return on that investment turned out to be wrong. But Leroy, generally, I'd have to agree with you.
Leroy, thanks a lot. We appreciate it. Let's move on to another topic that you cover in the Freakonomics radio series. A couple, if we have time, suicides and quitting, which I guess are somewhat perversely linked. Let's start with the difficult one, suicide. And what a stat. You note that it's twice as prevalent as homicide, but of course it gets much less attention.
Yeah, this when I first discovered this statistic, it's what made me want to do an hour on suicide. And I'll have to be honest with you, almost everybody I talked to said I should not do an hour of radio on suicide. That the topic is just too, it's not that it's too unsettling, you know what it is? It's too taboo. We don't talk about it. Some people have written about it, obviously, over the millennia, actually. And the attitudes toward it in past millennia were very different. But the fact is that in the current U.S., where murders have fallen a lot, murder is less than half as common as suicide. So why don't we hear about them? Well, for obvious reasons. It's not a crime, technically. It's not reported in the papers. But that led me to want to know a great deal more about it because since it's not so widely reported, what do we know and what don't we know? And it turns out, sadly to me, that there's far more that we don't know about suicide than we do know. So if you care about the topic at all, and since there are twice as many as there are homicides every year, obviously there are a lot more people who have familiarity with it than homicide. We need to know more. We need to figure out how it happens, whether enough is being done to prevent it, what kind of people are most prone to do it, and so on.
So here's a maybe unsettling clip from that show. One of your guests talking about what he calls America's suicide belt.
The American suicide belt is comprised of about 10 western states. It's sort of wide. A longitudinal swath running from Idaho and Montana down to Arizona and New Mexico. So, yes, the Intermountain West is a place that is disproportionately populated by middle-aged and aging white men, single, unattached, often unemployed, with access to guns. This may turn out to be a very powerful explanation and explain a lot of the variance that that we observe. It's backed up by the fact that the one state that has rates that is on is on par with what we see in the suicide belt is Alaska. If Alaska were contiguous with the U.S., it would really have to be considered part of this Western suicide belt.
So, aha, demographics matter.
Demographics matter a great deal, and there are a lot of surprises. So men are much more likely than women. We think we know the reason because men are more violent, men are more aggressive. But really, one of the big reasons is that men use guns, women don't. And guns are a good tool for a successful suicide, and many other methods are often unsuccessful. There are many, many surprises.
So states
here
with the more easy available of guns?
Absolutely. And you see that the Brady Bill actually had a significant effect on suicide, among other things.
I knew that.
You also find, for instance, that African Americans, for reasons that are quite hard to explain, a lot of people have different explanations, African Americans are less than half as likely as whites to commit suicide. And we look at rates around the world. The U.S. is kind of in the middle, upper middle. We visit Hungary, which is historically one of the most suicide-prone countries in the world, and we try to get to the question of why people do it. There are a lot of reasons. Drinking, drugs contribute, certainly. But the most – we called the episode the suicide paradox, the paradox being it seems as though as standard of living rises, so does the suicide rate, which seems entirely counterintuitive.
You would think poverty equates with suicide.
But it doesn't. And the explanation by psychologists and others seem to be that as you are getting – as you have the hope in the future of getting more stuff, that hope is valuable to you and it keeps you wanting to stay alive. When you get to where you thought would make you happy and it doesn't, what do you do then?
Hopelessness. And I wonder if males have a higher suicide rate than females also because they have weaker social networks. So if you're a guy and, you know, things are going well at work, your hedge fund is making you a lot of money, you can be pretty happy. But when it goes down the tubes, you don't have other human beings to fall back on, at least statistically speaking, as much as women do.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know the answer, but I would not be surprised if that turned out to be real. That sounds worth looking into, at least. Yeah.
And the last topic of yours that we're going to touch on this morning is quitting. I guess suicide could be the ultimate way of quitting, or is that too flip to draw that connection?
Yes, but we did as well. So, we called it for a while, we called the suicide episode the big quit. It is. But that is too flip, and there are many, many more pieces that go into it. Let me say one thing about quitting, though. It concerns the upside of quitting. In other words, there's the bromide that everybody knows, a winner never quits and a quitter never wins. And we wanted to ask the question, are you sure that's true? Like, what is the upside to quitting, and should we consider it, and should we even encourage people to quit more regularly and more and earlier than they do?
So one of the stories that you tell is that of a baseball player who gives up on that dream.
Well, when you're 25, playing an independent ball, making less than $2,000 a month, at some point you have to tell yourself, I can't do this to myself, I can't do this to my parents, and I can't continue when I know there's untapped potential to do other things.
So what did this former baseball player Justin Humphreys do instead?
So I love it. He went back to school. He was a bright kid, but, you know, he's all about baseball when he was young. Went back to school, ended up at Columbia University, where he had a sociology professor named Sudhir Venkatesh, who is a longtime Freakonomics character. He's studied drug dealers and prostitutes. So Sudhir Venkatesh, the sociologist, and Justin Humphreys, the former ball player, teamed up to study baseball quitting. And they did a sociodemographic survey of an entire draft class of 2001. And they found something really fascinating. Only 11% of the guys who are drafted by major league teams will ever make it to the majors at all. So very 1 out of 10. And many of them who make it are only there for a little while. So the vast majority will never get to do what they wanted to do. If you measure where those guys are in their lives versus a guy like them, same age, same background, who didn't go into baseball, you find that the former baseball players make about 40% less income, have all different kinds of disadvantages. In other words, they could have, should have quit. They would have been better off if they'd quit earlier, but because it's a dream, they can't quit.
Opportunity cost.
Opportunity cost, yeah.
You don't calculate the opportunity cost of coming on the show and wasting a half
inestimable.
Hour.
Inestimable.
Sadly, it is time for us to quit. I've been speaking with Stephen Dubner, host of Freakonomics Radio, which is co-produced by American Public Media's Marketplace, WNYC, and Dubner Productions. You can hear all these episodes we've talked about this week on WNYC at 3 o'clock on 93.9 FM, 8 o'clock in the evening on AM 820. Stephen Dubner, always fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Now, listeners, don't forget that every Tuesday at noon, which means right now, our politics website, It's a Free Country, hosts a live online chat. It's a chance to talk about the big issues of the day with our It's a Free Country team and special guests. Today's chat is on what comes next for same-sex marriage, some politics, but also some practical next steps here in New York, like a Freakonomics-y question on is there a marriage penalty that should lead some of you same-sex lovers to actually not tie the knot? At itsafreecountry.org right now.